And now a dream of no more war, 100 years after the beginning of the war that was supposed to end them all.
The peace that we here enjoy together as allies and partners does not simply mean no more bloodshed. It means something deeper than that. The fact that the presidents of Germany and Austria are here today, and that other nations, then enemies, are here too, bears testimony to the power of reconciliation.
Swirling in the memories and lessons of World War I and its aftermath is writer Stefan Zweig, a lover of the peaceful Europe before World War I, whose world collapsed in every way after 1914. George Prochnik is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. He explains that Zweig's troubled life is a metaphor for how the two world wars and the eventual destruction wrought by Adolf Hitler forever changed the identities of all the people of Europe.
Zweig had already been getting a lot of flack for not more openly denouncing Hitler's regime. And at this press conference that was called, at which many of the reporters were from Jewish publications, it was assumed that Zweig would take this opportunity to really come out strongly against Hitler and the Nazis. But instead, Zweig was incredibly evasive. And Zweig was so over-identified with the European continent that when he spoke of what was going on in Europe, the reporter said it was as though he was speaking about his own physical dismemberment. He said, in fact, he had never seen, of all the refugees, someone who seemed so battered and destroyed as Stefan Zweig. Zweig breaks down pity into two streams, two different types. He defines two different kinds of compassion. And he says, first of all, there's the kind of pity in which the one expressing the pity is merely trying to get rid of the person in front of them, begging some sort of assistance. And then, Zweig says, there's another kind of pity. And this other kind of pity involves an absolute identification with the object of compassion to the end and even beyond. There was one point near the end of his life when he received letters about a German city being bombed. And he wrote back that he couldn't feel elation at this, that every time a building fell with people in it, he collapsed with that building. He saw himself as that building. He couldn't accept even the idea of necessary opposition taking the form of killing innocent civilians. Mm. It was beyond him.
You know, the German authors that went through this epiphany, this transformation in the 20th century, along with Zweig, right, Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse. And of course, both Hesse and Mann lived beyond the war and wrote their great story of how they came to understand what happened. For Mann, it was Dr. Faustus, and for Hesse, it's The Glass Bead Game. And, you know, very different books. Do we wonder what Zweig might have written had he lived, you know, into the 1960s, as he easily could have, or, as your title suggests, The Impossible Exile? Was that impossible?
Well, if we try to imagine Zweig's response to the camps, I find that impossible. But in fact, in his memoir, he does do a rather extraordinary job of analyzing many of the reasons that this came about. And he really has a sort of tripartite explanation for how Hitler was possible. He writes, first of all, about the enormous power of propaganda, which he witnessed firsthand in the First World War in a number of instances. There's one very moving moving passage where he describes how he was in a small French city shortly before the outbreak of war at the cinema, and there were newsreels shown before the feature film. And in one of these newsreels, Wilhelm II steps off of a train and is there before the audience. And this entire audience of people who he felt were not particularly educated or educated not at all beyond the newspapers began booing and stamping their feet and just broke out into this bloodlust that amazed him, when these were people who were very friendly with him. He was himself, of course, a representative at this point of the other side of the conflict. So he saw how poisonous the effect of propaganda was. But he also, as a person who had invested so much of his life to the principle of enlightenment and education, this higher notion of education contained in the German word Bildung, he writes very compellingly about the failure of many intellectuals in the German-Austrian intellectual world to take Hitler seriously because he was so uneducated, that the very faith in enlightenment made it impossible in their eyes
for
a beer hall agitator, as Zweig describes Hitler at one point, to become the leader of Germany. They just couldn't see it.
Their intelligence was their blind spot.
Perfectly put, yes. And then he writes of how careful Hitler was to introduce his poisonous measures a drop at a time. He talks about this sort of inurement to this slow process of allowing the population to adjust to each measure, and then they would pass a law that was racist or what have you. They would remove a certain sector of society from any ability to work, and then they would wait. And he writes how this unfolded over a number of years, so that we might think almost of this idea of a tipping point with it, where things had gone so far before people realized how serious it was, that then when everything broke into the open with explicit brutal violence, people had already been desensitized to an extent that made it more palatable among sectors of society that it never should have been.
He really identifies the actual evil and genius of Hitler, this idea of demonizing an entire population one drop at a time.
I think he did. I think Zweig really saw that. And the book is Zweig's memoir is an amazing education in a number of very important and often overlooked social forces that led to that conflict.
100 years after the beginning of World War I, why is Zweig back? Why this revival?
I think there's really a confluence of reasons. One place to start would be, of course, with this Wes Anderson film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, which Wes Anderson notes at the end was inspired by the works of Stefan Zweig. But I think wherever people are on the political spectrum at this moment, we have a sense of personal freedom being jeopardized. We certainly find intellectual labor not necessarily valued in this culture. And many of Zweig's essays were really quite stunningly prescient about some of the issues that we face today. He talks about the what it means for news to be received 24/7 through the wireless, about this transition, so that people feel constantly besieged with the world's disasters and crushed wherever they are, sort of helplessly trying to identify, trying to create some barrier of in fact desensitization against these. And he speaks over and over about the desperate struggle between humanity's best influences, the positive and negative powers of technology to facilitate or impede this, and the threat to individuality. This is a huge theme for Zweig. So I think it's one reason that his work remains so compelling.
George Prochnik is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
You can catch up on that conversation and listen back to anything on the program if you check us out at thetakeaway.org. We want to let you know how to get an early jump on all of our conversations, especially for you new listeners. Be part of our listener response network by signing up for our texts. You'll get a text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. You can reply stop to just opt out. Thanks so much for listening, especially to our new listeners today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.